What's up, everyone? Welcome into another edition of the Pro Football Weekly podcast. So pleased that you could join us again this week. And I am joined by a very special guest. He has been just killing it at the website on as a freelance contributor this draft season, Marcus Mosher. Hopefully you guys have read his stuff by now. If you haven't, it's not too late. Marcus, thanks so much for taking some time. How's your day going?
Oh, it's going well, Arthur. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. The pleasure is all ours. I've been just smitten with the content that you've been providing to our website. So before we kind of get into a little draft talk, why don't you just explain really quickly to the listeners sort of where you're at on analytics? What got you started on kind of being so astute with data and helping it kind of form your arguments? Because it's sort of a new addition to PFW. And again, I really think it's been a huge added bonus to our coverage.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll make it really quick. So you know, growing up, I love football cards. It was just kind of the thing that, you know, we always did when we were kids. We would lay out our teams with our football cards. And the only way that you really got to know stats back in the early 90s was you had to look at your football cards. And that's kind of how you determine how good a player was, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. But I've always loved, you know, the tape, grinding the tape and all that kind of stuff. But I think there's a part of it where we need to be able to combine the analytics. And the more and more research I do with this, the more that it makes sense to combine the two. And we've done studies at Pro Football Weekly of does tackle for a loss production matter for college prospects? And we can absolutely say it does. You watch Aaron Donald in Pittsburgh, and that guy is in the backfield all the time. So it matches up that he has great tackle for a loss production. And you continue to put these numbers together with what you see on film, and the data matches, and it makes sense. So we're trying to find conclusions that make sense. We're not trying to be, overly analytical. We want to make these things that make sense. For lack of a better term, we are trying to figure out the best way to do this, but also make it so people understand what we're trying to do here.
Makes a ton of sense to me, and what I love about your work is that it's pretty clear that you grew up watching the game, and you're not someone who's just crunching numbers and using that solely to form your opinions, as you just kind of alluded to. So it's a really—
I'm terrible at math. Terrible at math. So we don't get too heavy into the math here.
I am surprised to hear that, but that I guess that gives me hope to maybe one day kind of get more into the analytics like yourself. But I should have mentioned at the top, too. It's Marcus Mosher. He's contributing to Pro Football Weekly. Find him on Twitter at Marcus_Mosher. And you can find out all his work on Bleacher Report, on the Locked On Cowboys podcast. He's all over the place. So, Marcus, let's talk Cowboys for a minute before we get back into the draft stuff and the data stuff. News broke today that Jerry Jones and Dez Bryant are going to meet Friday. We're recording here Wednesday evening. Your thoughts on— well, A, I think I already know what you're predicting is going to be the outcome of that meeting, but why don't you tell the listeners what the likely fate of Dez Bryant is and whether you think that's best for both Dez Bryant and the Cowboys?
All right, so here's the deal. I don't think anybody truly knows what's going to happen when Jerry Jones and Dez Bryant sit in that war room or sit in that meeting room. Right. We know that Jerry Jones loves Bryant. We know that Bryant loves being a Cowboy. So I think ultimately they would like to get something worked out. But from what I'm told, there's a lot of people in that front office and in the locker room that they're not convinced that Bryant is the same player he was in 2014. I'm even told that Dak Prescott wouldn't be opposed from Dez moving on and maybe giving some of these other younger receivers a chance. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. I do think Bryant would be open to taking a pay cut. I'm just not sure if that's going to be even offered to him on the Friday meeting. It sounds more and more like this is going to be a, Dez, we appreciate everything you've done for us, but we've decided to go in a different direction. And the reason for the meeting on Friday is that the Cowboys have their OTAs and workouts beginning on Monday. And if Bryant were somehow to get injured during weightlifting or practice, they would be on the hook for his $12.5 million salary. So my guess and my prediction is that they will move on from Dez. I don't think it's going to help out Prescott because they really don't have another number one receiver on the roster. They may be forced to draft a Calvin Ridley or Cortland Sutton in the first round. I still think Dez has something left in that tank. So we'll see what happens. But as of right now of this recording, I'm not optimistic that Bryant stays in Dallas.
Isn't he the type of receiver, Marcus, who even once he loses a step because he's so physical, because he's so aggressive after the catch, that if he could just stay healthy, which I know has been a huge issue the past 2 or 3 years, and if he could just establish a rapport with his quarterback, I know that's also been an issue. These are big ifs, obviously, but I feel like Dez's play style is one that maybe would allow him to continue to be productive even after that, you know, that speed, or he was never a speed guy, but even after that half step or step disappears.
Yeah, and I would think with a veteran quarterback that makes sense, but with a guy like Dak Prescott, who I really like, but Prescott doesn't have the anticipation that a Tony Romo had, or that a Drew Brees or Tom Brady had. I think he needs to go to a system where he can play with a quarterback that can throw him open. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Prescott is at that level yet. So I can see Bryant having success on another team. I'm just not sure it's in Dallas with Prescott at the quarterback position right now.
Is there anyone on that roster, any of the moves they've made, brought in Allen Hurns, brought in Deontay Thompson, anything excite mm-hmm. you with what's there currently? I know you said there's obviously no number one waiting in the wings as we sit here today.
Not really. we know what Terrence Williams is.
Yeah.
Allen Hurns is a lesser version of Bryant with maybe a little bit lesser athleticism. Cole Beasley had a down year last year, caught just 36 passes. Noah Brown is a big athletic receiver, but he just doesn't have the speed either. Deontay Thompson's kind of been a journeyman everywhere he's gone.
Right.
Ryan Switzer is really just a slot receiver to back up Cole Beasley. No, there's not a lot to be excited in the receiving corps. And even with Jason Witten turning 36 years old this summer, it's a slow, older group that doesn't have a lot of excitement and flash to it.
Not to make this a Cowboys-centric podcast, we'll move on in just a moment, but then what is your thoughts on the Cowboys' sort of bounce-back potential this year, even though obviously we haven't gotten to the draft yet? We don't know what they'll do with that 19th pick and how they'll improve the team in a couple weeks.
I just think this is an organization that is an 8-8 football team. They kind of have an 8-8 coach in Jason Garrett.
Yeah.
I think they're always going to be somewhat competitive. I think they can compete with any team in the league. But it seems like they have trouble overcoming obstacles. And we saw that last year when Ezekiel Elliott was gone. They went 3-3, and they had three really bad losses. When Tyron Smith was out of the game, they let up 6 sacks to Adrian Claiborne and the Falcons. It's an okay team. And in that loaded NFC, I just don't see them, you know, becoming a 10-11 win team all of a sudden.
All right, so let's stick with wide receivers for a minute. I know that's your particular area of expertise over at Bleacher Report, where you scout the wide receivers and tight ends for the NFL 1000 project. You mentioned Cortland Sutton and Calvin Ridley as, you know, I guess first-round prospects, potentially. I don't want to put words in your mouth, actually, but you mentioned, you know, they may be, the Cowboys specifically may be forced to go in on one of those guys because of their situation. What do you think about the class as a whole? And I know you're very fond of one guy that you didn't mention in those first two as we open this discussion.
Yeah, that guy that you're referencing is DJ Moore. I think he is a star. But overall, this is a deep receiver class. This might be the deepest receiver class that I've ever seen. The difference between wide receiver 1 and wide receiver 20 is as small as I think we really have ever seen. And I think this is a group that it really depends on what you're looking for in a receiver. If you want a guy that's going to go up and get the football, I mean, there's a ton of guys in this class between Cortland Sutton, Auden Tate, Alan Lazard, Simi Cobb. If you're looking for the route runner specialist, there's Deshaun Hamilton from Penn State, Anthony Miller from Memphis, Calvin Ridley from Alabama. It's a great group. It just depends on what you need. I'm not thrilled with some of the first-round options outside of DJ Moore, but I think you can get a very quality receiver in the second, third, and fourth round this year.
Be still Marcus's heart when he mentions DJ Moore, and I can't stress enough, guys, you got to check it out. He's done 2 or 3 pieces for us already on the wide receiver specifically, and I love the one where you found like the stat that really matters for each of the top wide receiver prospects. Just awesome stuff, and I know you've highlighted DJ Moore's run after catchability quite a bit at Pro Football Weekly. Let me ask you, just sticking with the wide receivers for one more minute, we're chatting with Marcus Mosher on the Pro Football Weekly podcast. Check us out on iTunes, subscribe to us while you're there, and a rating and review. That would be super awesome. Marcus, what do you think about the miss rate in the first round for wide receivers over, I want to say, the past three drafts now. Ever since that epic 2014 class, it seems like teams can't really, you know, hit the ocean if they're standing on the beach at the wide receiver position.
Yeah, it's been interesting because we really haven't had a super elite prospect. We've had a lot of flawed prospects, even going back to Amari Cooper in 2015. Kevin White, that you're familiar with.
Yep.
Part of the reason is that these teams just aren't letting these receivers develop. We talk about all the time how that third year is really when you start to see that breakout season. But many of these guys are forced into action way too early. And what I'm seeing is a lot of lack of confidence with these players. Laquan Treadwell is a perfect example. He got with a offensive coordinator in North Turner who basically told him right away, hey, you're not playing as a rookie. I don't care what you do in training camp. I don't care what you do in the season. You're not playing as a rookie because that's not the way we do things around here. Mike Zimmer kind of tore into him. And now we're entering year three having no idea what Laquan Treadwell is. I'm still optimistic that he can make plays. But have the Vikings given up on him already after 2 years? I don't know. What we do know is that some teams like the New England Patriots have basically given up on trying to develop young players at the receiver position, and they're letting other teams develop them for them, trading picks for those guys, signing them in free agency because they know it takes a long time for these guys to develop. I think we kind of got spoiled with the 2014 class, and I believe it was that 2011 class that had A.J. Green and Julio Jones.
Yep.
We had just a lot of superstars at the position that came out and played really, really well early on in their careers. I think what we've seen in the 15, 16, 17 draft is more indicative of what we're going to see from the receiver position. It takes a while for these guys to learn that spot. It's tough.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, at the skill spots, and I think you could probably throw a corner in there too. And I've heard Mike Zimmer say it himself that that's another one of the positions that's just really tough to come in and master. Maybe the two non-quarterback positions, arguably wide receiver and corner. So let's go there. I know you're working on a piece right now for us, Marcus. It's kind of a carryover or sort of a continuation in the series of trying to find the correlation between college production and athleticism and how it translates to the NFL. And I may be getting out over my skis, and if I am, just let me know. But where are you at on that piece in regard to your findings and maybe any surprises or validations of what you expected going in?
Yeah, so the latest piece that I'm working on for Pro Football Weekly, which I'll actually be turning into you later tonight, is how does pass deflections translate to the NFL? Is that a stat that is predictive in terms of production? And for the most part, it is. If you get your hands on a lot of footballs in college, you're probably going to do the same in the NFL. The best example that I can give you is William Jackson, the cornerback from Cincinnati. In his 1 year at Houston, he had 23 pass deflections and 5 interceptions. And despite missing his entire rookie season with the Bengals, he came in this year and was one of the best 5 cornerbacks in the league. It's not a completely predictive measure. There are cornerbacks who have had great production and have failed. But if you have a guy that is a good athlete and has that college production, you're going to do pretty well. And in this class, two of our top-rated cornerbacks at Pro Football Weekly, Denzel Ward and Josh Jackson, both have elite college production. I believe Jackson had 18 pass deflections this year and 8 interceptions. Denzel Ward had 16. I expect both those guys to be instant playmakers right away when they get in the NFL, and both should be top 20 picks.
Yeah, and we're not talking about run-of-the-mill interceptions with Josh Jackson. I mean, I'm sure people have seen the highlights. This dude makes just absurd plays on the football. What do you think? You hear often, it's a bit kind of, you know, it's sort of beaten like a dead horse, actually, that wide receivers and cornerbacks are stopwatch-driven positions. There was concern initially after the combine or at the combine because Josh Jackson, I think, posted like a 4.56 40 or something. And therefore, people seem to not want to pay attention to the fact that he tested not quite elite athletically, but he was really good everywhere else. How do you reconcile that? I don't know. That might be a rare instance with him, but how do you kind of weigh the 40 time versus all the other important measurables there for these corners?
Yeah, for having a average or below average 40 for a corner isn't a killer. We saw Richard Sherman Had a average 40. I think he ran in the mid 4.5s. But his explosiveness was fantastic, and that's the same for Josh Jackson. A 38-inch vertical is one of the best in the class, a 6'8", 6'3 cone, a 4.03 short shuttle. Those are all fantastic times for a cornerback. And with a guy with his wingspan and his arm length and his college production, I really don't have any concerns about Jackson going forward.
Any under-the-radar guys that you've kind of unearthed in this study? People maybe day two or day three. I know that's a premium position where teams are going to pounce early, but anyone maybe excites you that you weren't necessarily anticipating having that reaction to?
Yeah, DJ Reed, the cornerback from Kansas State. Not very big, 5'9", 188. Kind of an average athlete across the board. But in terms of college production was just absolutely fantastic. 3 interceptions, 16 pass deflections, a total of 39 pass deflections over his career in Kansas State. I'm curious to see where he's going to land, but that's a guy that, hey, you're going to bet on the college production even if the measurables aren't great.
And did you think that it was I know it was an unusual year, obviously, with guys like Marshawn Lattimore and Tre'Davious White both excelling, and there were a couple other rookie corners who played really well, too. Were you real high on those guys coming out last year? Do you think that maybe the schemes allowed them? Actually, they were quite different, right? I think White was playing a lot more zone, and Marshawn was pressing a lot more. But what do you think led to such unusual production for those two studs in Buffalo and New Orleans?
Yeah, so White's an interesting one. He's going to be kind of the feature player of the piece, but he was a guy at LSU who was super productive all 4 years he was there. It's rare that a freshman starts at LSU. He started for 4 years, racked up 34 career pass deflections. He became one of the best pass deflections per game defender in all of college football. He has very average athleticism, but his college production was so great that we shouldn't be surprised that he transitioned so quickly into the NFL. And Marshawn Lattimore is actually just the opposite. His college production was very average,
right,
but his athleticism was so good that he was able to make up for it in the NFL. And part of it, too, with Lattimore, if we're being honest, was he was so good at Ohio State, the team just didn't throw at him.
Right.
And that's something that these metrics can't account for. If teams are just completely ignoring a cornerback because of how dominant he is, the stats aren't going to show up. But in the case of Lattimore, great athlete. Average college production, got into the NFL, got with the perfect team for his skill set, and just played extremely well.
I'm guessing it doesn't hurt that these guys are coming with, coming from big time programs with reputations of churning out these players. At obviously LSU, and you throw Alabama in the mix as well alongside Ohio State. Marcus, we got about another, 7-8 minutes left. I got to just ask you, the Cleveland Browns are fascinating. They kind of hold the keys to this draft. They got away from analytics, obviously, and hired their football guys. And it's like the ultimate irony to me. It seems like some anxiety is growing that John Dorsey may find a way to screw this up at number one overall.
This one's frustrating because Sashi didn't die for this. And I don't mean actually die. But this one's frustrating because I think this is the one time where most football people and analytics people both agree that Josh Allen shouldn't be a top 20 pick. And people are just screaming on Twitter that he shouldn't be it. And for some reason, somebody in that organization or a couple people in that organization, I think they might want to prove people wrong with Allen. I'm wondering if it's a pride thing because I don't see anybody else out here showing that or saying that Allen should be the number one pick. The Browns seem like the only people that are saying this. Are they trying to prove us wrong that they know more than we do? I don't know. I don't know if there's a rational explanation for what the Browns may be doing here in the next couple of weeks.
Are you you think where there's smoke here, there's probably a raging inferno soon to follow. This isn't going to be the ultimate facade, and they're going to go maybe Sam Darnold or in a different direction. You feel pretty confident. I know a lot of the insiders reporting from Jeremiah to, I think, Zuerlein today, saying it really does look like Josh Allen.
For the Browns fans' sake, I really hope that's what it is. I hope this is just a big show. I don't know what the reason would be for it, but I hope they go Sam Darnold. I want to see the Browns prosper, but my gut tells me that, yeah, Josh Allen's probably going to end up being the number one pick in Cleveland.
And it's weird, too, because Dorsey assembled that really talented front office with all the Packers cast-offs, obviously. He's got, you know, McLuhan and Wolf and Highsmith there, and those guys don't strike me as yes men. So, I don't know. It is fascinating.
It's odd.
Yeah, it really is an odd deal. What do you think about the quarterback class as a whole? I think I just heard you say Sam Darnold, you believe, should be the first pick. Are you as high on this class as others?
Yeah, I think this is the best class that I've maybe ever seen. I truly believe there's four franchise quarterbacks in this class, and Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, Baker Mayfield, and Lamar Jackson. And if you look at the next couple classes, and I know this is tough to do, but if you look at the 2019 and 2020 class, there's not many names in there that excite you. So if you need a quarterback or you think you're going to need a quarterback in the next couple of years, this is your class to make your move, get your quarterback, because I think in any other year, there's four guys here that should be the number one overall pick, and it just happens to be we've got four of them here, and probably none of those four are actually going to be the number one pick with Josh Allen going number one. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, no one's happier than teams like the Jets and potentially the Broncos and maybe the Giants. What do you think the Giants are thinking at number two? Are they being real quiet and maybe Darnold is their guy and they can't believe this is about to work out their way?
Yeah, I kind of think that Darnold's their guy as well. I think if Darnold does go one, my guess is they'll take a positional player, probably Saquon Barkley or Bradley Chubb at two. But if a prospect like Sam Darnold falls into their laps, I think that would be the perfect situation for him. Sit behind Eli Manning for a year. Sam Darnold is going to be the youngest quarterback ever to be drafted. He's just 20 years old. I think that would be a great situation for him.
Yeah, it does sound like it. Just a couple more minutes here with Marcus Mosher on the Pro Football Weekly podcast. Make sure you're checking out his work on Twitter at Marcus_Mosher and over at Bleacher Report, Locked On Cowboys, and of course, ProFootballWeekly.com. Marcus, is there one or two prospects this year that sort of has you conflicted between the tape and maybe the numbers that you like to rely on as well? Some guys that you just expected a different outcome for and you can't quite put your finger on?
Yeah, for me, it's Leighton Vander Esch, the linebacker from Boise State, because you look at all the athletic testing numbers and you look at all of his production last year at Boise State, and that looks like a guy that should be a top 12 pick. And depending on what game you watch, you can kind of justify that conclusion. If you watch the Oregon game, the final game of the season, he looks like a top 10 player. But there's just too many games that you're left wondering, can he take on blocks in the NFL? Is this going to be a guy that can play middle linebacker? Does he have physicality to play that position? He's a former volleyball player who really didn't do anything his first couple years at Boise State, came on in the second half of this year. This is a case where are you going to trust that eventually he's going to fill out his athletic body and he's going to learn the position, or is he always going to be kind of a guy that leaves you wanting more? My comparison for him is a former Dallas Cowboy linebacker, Bobby Carpenter, a guy that you always wish was a little bit tougher, but that athleticism always shined through. So Leighton Vander Esch is a guy that I can't figure out. I'm sure he's going to go in the top 20 of the draft. I'm just hoping it's not to my team.
I believe he is a one-year starter like Josh Jackson, so maybe that means there's kind of more room to grow there as well. But I know he has exciting tape, maybe if not the most consistent tape. Lastly, Marcus, what about the guys? I asked you a bunch about wide receivers, but not as much on tight ends. And I guess to go from, off the ball linebacker to tight ends is a decent segue. Obviously, it's not last year's class with three first rounders, but can you get it behind a Dallas Goedert or a Mike Gesicki? Are there guys you like more later? What do you think of that position?
Yeah, I actually think this is another really good tight end class. It's not as deep as it was last year. But it's a group where you can get a solid starter into the second and third round. I like Dallas Goedert as my number one tight end. I know people are going to like Gesicki because of his athleticism. Mm-hmm. The guy that I really like is Ian Thomas, the tight end from Indiana. He's probably the best blocking tight end of the class. And if you're going to run a balanced offense that requires your tight end to maintain the edge and get to the second level, Ian Thomas can do that. He reminds me a little bit of George Kittle, the tight end to come out of Iowa last year that was drafted for the 49ers. I just like those guys that can still help you in both the run and pass game. And I think you can probably get Ian Thomas somewhere between the third and fifth round. So that's the guy that I really like. But Dallas Goedert, Mike Gesicki, Mark Andrews, Hayden Hurst, those are your top four guys, your premium pick tight ends.
And just a quick follow-up to that, what about Hayden Hurst? And I believe in one somewhat dubious, he shares one dubious distinction with Calvin Ridley, one of these overaged rookies. If you're a front office guy, if you're the one making one of those decisions, how much you worry about that? Do you feel like they just have to, are they more concerned about making sure they get as much production out of the rookie contract as possible? Or how do you think they factor in the age concerns with some of these prospects?
Yeah, I don't hate players with older, but I do prefer players that are younger, if that makes sense. I'm not going to knock a guy because they're older, but in the case of, like a Mike Gesicki, who is a younger prospect, or an Ian Thomas, I would just prefer taking those guys that have more room to grow. I think Hayden Hurst will be fine. I believe he'll turn 25 when the season starts. With the NFL going the way that it is, where you're really just using these guys on their rookie contracts and then letting them hit free agency or letting them move on, it's not the biggest concern in the world. But I probably wouldn't spend a premium pick on Hayden Hurst. I'd probably wait until late second, early third round to grab a guy like him.
All right. Outstanding stuff. That is Marcus Mosher. And again, he's been killing it at Pro Football Weekly and pretty much everywhere he is covering the draft for. So make sure you check him out. Marcus, I really appreciate your time tonight. And I can't wait to read the defensive back college production athleticism piece here in a little bit.
Hey, Arthur, thanks for having me on.
Of course, that is. Once again, Marcus Mosher on the Pro Football Weekly podcast.